I Hate Politics is a podcast dedicated to exploring a human activity we love to hate. We look at human life, culture, economics closest to us, in our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and in our local governments. Together, we'll explore how politics is central to getting things done in societies where we treasure diverse views and preferences. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. I've spent my life studying politics, and I know this. Unless we want to live in a dictatorship or a monarchy, we are stuck with politics. Politics is more than just Trump, Biden, or elections. It's how we fix potholes, make our streets safer, where we put our schools, and decide who goes to them. It's about coming together as a community. It's about us. Let's go find those stories. For this episode, we were planning to focus on the problem of pedestrian safety in the Washington, D.C. region. We were simultaneously preparing for the next show that was going to look at how to advocate with MCPS, Montgomery County Public Schools. But as we began to put the two shows together, we realized that what we had was something quite unexpected and fascinating on our hands, a comparative exploration of two very different advocacy styles. And so we put the two shows together to build a mega episode around advocacy styles. Our guests today, Miriam Schonbaum and Bruce Adelson, represent two very different approaches to local advocacy. For the last few years, Miriam has organized roadside memorials for pedestrians and bicyclists who have been killed by vehicles in Montgomery County. She invites the family, local leaders, neighbors, and community members to attend to build public awareness of non-motorist road deaths and to push local leaders to develop public policy that makes our streets safer. Her approach to advocacy differs vastly from that of our second guest, Bruce Adelson, winner of the PTA President of the Year Award in 2018 for the county PTA organization. Bruce pins his success as a PTA leader on being able to sit in boardrooms with MCPS officials who had the power and the authority to present well-researched arguments and evidence using his legal training. He played the inside game based on access and knowledge. Bruce did not know the MCPS structure when he started in the PTA, but he learned quickly in part because of his legal training and years of litigation experience and found success where many others have failed. Bruce and Miriam provide two very contrasting styles of advocacy, which reflect at some level who they are. And listening to them back to back reveals not just the many ways of engaging with your local government, but quite different understandings of where the locus of change lies. But first, the news roundup. The biggest news this week is that MCPS, Montgomery County Public Schools, has decided to bring students back to school buildings starting in March. Those going back are limited to students whose families had chosen the hybrid option in the family survey conducted by MCPS earlier. It is unclear what the shape of in-person learning is going to be. MCPS has put out a recruitment notice for about 800 monitors, not new teachers, but adults or supervised classroom. The staffing in schools suggests that some in-person time will be virtual learning while in school. Most importantly, the exact shape of in-person learning will vary greatly from school to school. This is, at one level, a recognition that different communities have different needs, but also a way for the school district leadership to diffuse accountability for the choices being made. Teachers Union and the Principals Union has come out with deep, deep reservations about MCPS's reopening plan. The Teachers Union passed a resolution of no confidence, and the Principals Union has written a strongly worded letter of protest, which said that MCPS was not only changing plans on the fly, but some of the promises it was making were simply not doable. The county health officer, Dr. Travis Gales, and County Executive Mark Elrich made statements that appeared to side with the teachers and the principals. Expect this debate to heat up as the Biden administration tries to keep its promise of restarting in-person learning soon. The impeachment trial of Donald Trump has been national and international news. The local story is Maryland District 8 Congressmember Jamie Raskin, the lead impeachment manager, arguing the case. Congressman Raskin is a beloved politician, especially in southern Montgomery County. His eloquent and organized prosecution of the impeachment has catapulted him to a national and international star. Here in Montgomery County, where he lives, his reputation could not be any further burnished. Raskin and others like him, who are beloved in their districts, raise a conundrum in politics. We the people don't like politicians in general, and certainly not the Congress, but we love our own Congress member. So of course we keep sending the same person back to Congress again and again. But because every district does this, the Congress never ever changes, and we continue to dislike Congress. We will look at this conundrum in the future. Back closer to home, it seems that White's Ferry, the Potomac crossing between Poolesville in Montgomery County and Loudoun County, Virginia, might be coming back, with the ferry being sold to a new owner. We'll be right back. Miriam Schonbaum, welcome to I Hate Politics podcast. How big a problem is road safety in Montgomery County and in the adjoining jurisdictions?
Well, last year we had 17 non-motorists and 45 people dead altogether on the roads. So that's a little bit less than one a week. That's higher than it was several years ago. And that fits in with countrywide data. Countrywide, you're seeing deaths among motorists decrease. You're seeing deaths among bicyclists and pedestrians increase. And also with the COVID pandemic, you saw an increase in deaths despite the decrease in travel. And that's primarily because drivers were driving faster and more dangerously because there were fewer cars on the roads. Now, compared to Prince George's County, you know, which really unfortunately leads the region in traffic deaths, Montgomery County does better. But, you know, again, everybody's bad. It's just that Prince George's County is worse. And honestly, if we did memorials in Prince George's County, I don't think that we would even be able to keep up.
Let me ask you a little bit about your personal history in this. How did you come to advocate for pedestrian safety? Where did you begin?
Advocating, well, I started with ACT because the state.
Let me interrupt you for a second. With ACT, by ACT, you mean Action Committee for Transit.
Sorry, yes. Right? I started with Action Committee for Transit because the state proposed closing my MAR commuter rail station that I used. And I tried to fight that and got involved with Action Committee for Transit.
Which station is that?
That was Boyd's. So that was in 2005, 2006. They proposed closing four stations in the state. And so, you know, got started with MARC advocacy. I live in Boyd so that I can walk to the MARC station instead of having to drive. And maybe around 2012, ACT as an organization realized that, you know, if you get killed on your way to the bus, or if you're afraid to walk to the bus, you're not going to take the bus, and that therefore you could not separate pedestrian and bicycle issues from transit issues, that they, you know, pedestrian and bicycle issues are transit issues. So, you know, so we started looking at pedestrian deaths in the county. And then in July 2019, there were There was one pedestrian death at the Bethesda Trolley Trail, and then there was the death of a high school student on a bicycle who ran into something that was blocking the sidewalk and fell into the road. And at that point, I'd looked at ghost bike ceremonies that other people had done, and I thought we really need to start doing roadside ceremonies in Montgomery County to acknowledge the lives of the people who were killed and to get the policymakers and the elected officials on site, on foot, to see what it's like to be a pedestrian or a bicyclist in the area where the person was killed.
So, I have been at many of your memorials, and what has been striking about them to me is that in many cases, these are people that, they don't have families nearby. They are not, in fact, memorialized. And, in a couple of cases, it was just you and me. So is there a difference? Did you see that a lot?
When we started doing the memorials, we decided we had to reach out to the families before we did anything.
Sure.
The first two memorials were in Bethesda, and honestly, middle-class people are relatively easy to find via the internet, or even with a million people in Montgomery County, people know people who know people.
Right.
So middle-class people are easy to find. The communities of some of the other people killed were not so easy to find. And in some cases, people were clearly in communities. It's just I had no contact to those communities. And in others, the people seemed to be more isolated and on their own.
What other organizations in the DMV area do this or do similar things?
In DC, I think that the Bike DC community does do ghost bikes, especially for their own. There is more of a tradition of ghost bikes, and I think that's partly because there is more of a community of bicyclists. And I think it's also partly because there are fewer bicyclists killed, that, keeping up with pedestrians killed just from an event planning perspective, mm-hmm. Never mind the emotional work or, the fact of the death itself, just sure. The event planning is a lot of work,
right.
In Montgomery County, which is not that bad.
Yeah, I can imagine how much work that goes into it. You get shoes ready, you get a plaque ready, you get flowers, and you are ready to mount. So you have to have, been to that area before, checked it out. I know that you bring a ladder sometimes, a chair sometimes, in order to be able to get up high so that it's visible. That's a lot of work. I am completely in awe of the effort that you put in. And thank you. The podcast is premised on the idea that, there is politics everywhere in our communities, in our neighborhoods. Preventing crash deaths is a moral issue, right? Obviously, everybody agrees this is egregious. Everybody says one death is too many. There is a policy problem that lies behind it. And behind that, I believe there's a political issue, right? Can you describe to me what the policy problem is with respect to pedestrian death, especially in Montgomery County? And then we can talk about the politics behind it.
Fundamentally, the policy issue is, 100 years of transportation engineering that's based on the principle that roads are for cars.
Sure.
And if you want to go somewhere, you get in a car. Everything else is secondary to car transportation. And following on to that is the idea that, the worst thing that can happen is vehicle delay, that people should be able to get into a car and go where they're going without any delay as fast as possible and not have anything get in their way. and pedestrians and bicyclists get in the way, basically. They get in the way of moving cars. So we have this transportation system that is based on the idea of moving cars. And pedestrians and bicyclists are basically grit in the system that, you know, they're a problem that would be best solved by getting rid of them altogether and then, you know, and everybody in a car. So that's, you know, that's the basic policy problem. So you're going up against, you know, 100 years of this with billions of dollars invested into that kind of road transportation system, you know, and then here we come along and say, you know, people should not be able to drive as fast as they want to get where they're going because it kills people. And it's kind of it's a radical statement.
Right. The thing, though, is politicians do what people want. So in terms of sort of getting a vehicle throughput on the streets, do you think that's what people want and politicians deliver? Or do you think there's been a change in the culture and the politicians are lagging behind?
I don't think there's a simple answer to that. You know, from terms of, you know, in terms of what people want, everybody who drives wants to be able to drive as fast as they can through other people's neighborhoods to get where they're going. But they, you know, I want to drive through your neighborhood fast because I got places to go, but I don't want you to drive through my neighborhood fast because nobody likes that.
Right.
You know, that's one problem. Talking to people, though, you know, maybe they're just being polite, but, you know, when I say, you know, people can slow down, what's the darn hurry? You know, so you get to the next light 30 seconds later, what's the problem? You know, I've found a surprising amount of support for the principle that, you know, my fast driving shouldn't kill you.
Right.
So that's good. You know, politicians, we all grew up in this roads are for cars culture. There's the big culture shift. And then there's, you know, the funding issues. There are the transportation agencies themselves, which are a bureaucracy. It's basically, you know, trying to, here's a mixed metaphor. It's trying to move a huge ship while rebuilding it, which costs money, and the crew doesn't actually necessarily all want it to move or get rebuilt.
So what I hear you say really is that there is a public support for slowing down cars, but that public support does not translate into policy and certainly doesn't translate because the agencies that are in charge of this policy, right, of managing the roads, the departments of transportation, are not schooled in the old 100 years of road culture.
Well, I mean, so either it doesn't translate into policy or it translates into policy, which, you know, the bureaucracies are able to ignore. That's another issue in Montgomery County, because in Montgomery County, there are the state roads, so that's the Maryland State Highway Administration, and there are the county roads, so that's Montgomery County Department of Transportation, and then there are the municipal roads, so that's like, you know, City of Gaithersburg, City of Rockville. And you would think, you know, because that's not complicated enough, you know, the county is responsible for some City of Gaithersburg roads, or, you know, the county is responsible for the timing of the traffic signals on State Highway Administration roads. Or, you know, it just, or, you know, whose sidewalk is this? It just gets really complicated really fast. And, you know, if you're a regular person who doesn't have this really stupid hobby that I have, you know, the result, I think, is you get discouraged and you give up because you can't even figure, you know, you want a sidewalk in your neighborhood and you can't even figure out who you're supposed to ask.
If you could organize this, how would you organize?
What I would like, if there were one portal where people could just ask for what they wanted, and get a response that wasn't, that's not our responsibility, we're sending it to this agency. I think that would already be a big help.
But 311 was supposed to do that.
Well, yes, it was, yes.
Does it do it?
You know, if you submit the walk signal is out, request through 311, usually it gets fixed.
How long does it take, do you know?
Like 3 weeks, maybe.
And have you ever had occasion to two and two together and said that a walk signal was not working and somebody was hit by a car?
There was an intersection that I just happened to be at while I was looking at something else. And I was actually there in the car and I looked across Mid-County Highway and I said, there is a bus up there on the other side of Mid-County Highway that, you know, you can't get to unless you run across six lanes of Mid-County Highway. Right. And I emailed the state, I emailed the county, and I said, you know, there needs to be safe crossing here. There needs to be a sidewalk here. And a week or two later, somebody was killed there. And that, you know, I don't like saying I told you so about that. It's a horrible feeling.
It is horrible.
You know, and if I can see that it's dangerous with no background or training, I'm just looking and I happen to be there. You know, where are the professionals in this?
Right. There is a bill right now in Annapolis in the General Assembly that shifts the speed setting authority on state roads in the county to the county government or to the county Department of Transportation. Are you looking at that? Are you hopeful about that?
So each agency has its strengths and weaknesses, and and political pressure points and political intervention points. If you asked me, you know, here's a problem and you need to fix it, do you want it to be a state road or do you want it to be a county road? I don't know which I'd pick.
That's interesting. I would have thought that bringing the authority closer to the people, having the authority being exercised in the county, as opposed to the state, might make them more responsive in terms of reducing speeds.
That's certainly how it should work.
If someone wanted to improve pedestrian bicycle safety in Montgomery County, what should they do?
Well, I'd say the number one thing, if you're a person who isn't already walking and biking, is to get out and walk and bike and look. You know, that a lot of it is just observing the world around you, you know, and thinking about it. Why do people cross here? Why does this not feel safe? What would I do to fix it if I could do it here? You know, just identifying the problems. That it, when you see the world from behind a windshield, it looks a lot different.
Okay.
So that's one thing. Another thing is to talk to your neighbors, talk to your coworkers, even if they still drive, you know, to make them know about, you know, unmarked crosswalks and speed limits, and make sure that you when you're turning left, that's a hazard. Don't hit people, because people don't want to hit people.
Yeah, but do you think that driving education needs to be fixed? I have a, young teenager who is on the verge of this. Do you think driver's ed needs to be fixed?
Well, so my daughter actually just went through driver's ed, and because she is my daughter, poor kid, and hears about it all at home, she was, for the driving laws part of it, sort of already at the driving law 301 stage. Would it be good if drivers were more educated? Yes, it really would. A big overhaul would surely be part of the solution.
What's the third thing?
You know, the third thing I think fits right in with your podcast, to realize that, you know, when you contract your elected officials to say, you know, hey, you work for me and I'm a voter and this is what I want in my community, you know, that's politics. And, you know, nothing affects your daily life so much as your local government. And, you know, people often don't pay any attention to it. But when it goes wrong, then you notice.
Thank you, Miriam. We really appreciate it. I'll be right back with Bruce Adelson. Bruce Adelson, welcome to I Hate Politics podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with all that you did for MCPS. Can you tell us?
Sure. I was the Winston Churchill High School PTA president for 2 years, and I was gratified to be named the Montgomery County PTA president of the year 2018 to 2019. Before that, I had been the first vice president of the Hoover Middle School PTA, and I've been involved, had been involved in various other PTA situations and events and programs. But my Churchill tenure was marked by significant events that, you know, you just kind of get caught up in things. And sometimes you are in the position you're in because of coincidence. If I had known before I became PTA president that all the things that happened to Churchill would have happened, it would have been like just unreal to live through. But, you know, being on the other side of them, I'm very proud of what we were able to achieve and the changes that we were able to make.
Then let's get to it. After 2 years of reflection, what do you think were your biggest successes and where do you think you came up short?
Well, I think let's start with the coming up short. I think that one of my priorities as a professional and have, you know, being an attorney, being a former Department of Justice law enforcement attorney, and then being a graduate school professor now, is educating people, empowering them in various aspects of life, certainly in this context, as they affect their children. And not everyone takes the perspective that a problem is solvable, let's say. So if their child is a victim of bullying, for example, because of national origin or race, just as an example, and then those are things that I did encounter. Right. You know, I would advise and counsel them and make suggestions about how you can stop that, how you can intervene and have a very productive conversation with the school and with MCPS leadership. But I wasn't always successful in convincing people that they should intervene that way. Sometimes their children were very concerned that they might be treated adversely. They were concerned about their parents getting involved. Sometimes from where the parents were coming from, that, you know, I just don't want to get involved. I don't want to do that. I regret that. I wish that more people had jumped in, so to speak, and really pushed for change, particularly when it comes, I mean, just speaking parent to parent.
Right.
When it comes to their children, I mean, and their children face just awful situations. Just, I should tell you, coincidentally, one of the students who is now in college, I've had some communications with, and he was the victim of a significant hazing and bullying based on race. Mm-hmm. He still experiences them almost in a PTSD type of way, that he said that he still has nightmares and these things still affect him very deeply. At the time, nothing was done. I mean, his family didn't intervene. His parents didn't complain. He didn't complain. And I think that, frankly, you know, I don't know, I hadn't thought about this before. Maybe I look at this as one of the successes that you mentioned. He has kind of traveled to the path where now his perspective is, you know, and some a couple of things have come up recently for him at college. He said, you know what? I'm going to complain. I'm going to go talk to the professor. I'm going to go talk to the coach because this is just not acceptable. So I just feel awful about what happened to him and other children when I was involved with the PTA and my son was at MCPS schools. But I guess I wish that more people would put themselves out there for their children and say, no, that's not acceptable. That's not going to happen. And you're going to make changes so that my child is no longer victimized.
So it is my experience that it's a chicken and egg problem, right? It's not just most people don't get up and start to, you know, try to change the system because they feel that there is no effective path. That they don't know who to go to or how to go to. And they've been, you know, when they have been to principals or directors or whoever, they get a wall in front of them. And secondly, I think it's also important to say that my own experience has been MCPS is more willing to talk to you about your individual child. But when it comes to a situation where you policy matter, that's a different approach.
I think you're right. I think that you know, MCPS has its way, which frankly, I think could be a rather, you know, insidious way to deal with this in managing people, managing situations, managing problems. I mean, they can be very self-protective and they can be more interested potentially in resolving certain individual situations. Yeah, I agree with that. And that's assuming that the advocacy is done effectively and the position is presented well with, you know, evidence and the argument is good, all of that stuff. And I agree. I think that sometimes they are slower or more resistant to what we describe the justice as pattern and practice issues. However, I should also say that I had conversations with them about a lot of pattern and practice issues. And that while they didn't move as far as I would like in certain situations, let me just give you an example.
Sure.
It's something that's not publicly known. I think there was a ninth grade teacher at Churchill who was during a class as a male teacher. There was some conversation and he kissed a girl on her forehead. She was, to say, taken aback is an understatement. And the students in class were taken aback too. So as a result of this, that the school contacted MCPS. MCPS did in some level of investigation, pulled the teacher out. I think this was a Friday. And then he returned to class on Monday. And I had a larger conversation within MCPS about sexual harassment and inappropriate contact, let's say, between staff and children. And I want to stress the word children and also add minor children. And this was both a child, of course, and a minor. So in discussing the response of MCPS and how this might be indicative of a larger situation, and frankly, why they didn't put out any notice to parents, they didn't disclose this, they didn't have any kind of open conversation. A lot of parents didn't know that this happened. I knew because the principal contacted me and there were some parents whose kids were in the class who complained. So during this MCPS conversation, one of the, she was at the time an associate superintendent. She said, you know, I'm very leery about disclosing information like this publicly. And I asked why. She said, because in her career, she worked with teachers and staff who were wrongly accused, it's in her opinion, and that this affected their careers. And my response was, well, hold on. Here you have a situation of an adult male kissing a minor child in public in a class. I will tell you that if my child had been in that class, I would want to know. If I were not told that, I would be very upset. So I think that one of the things you should be looking at here is, you know, we need to be more transparent. We need to put out information like this. And the consequences will flow from there. So you're handling this in-house and keeping it quiet. That is not a good solution. And I think you need to look at your own response in your own career to how, you know, whatever your colleagues experience, this person did this. It's not like there's some issue here and we're uncertain and we have to do a full investigation. This was done in front of 25 children. So there's no question that this person did what he did. And that kind of makes your explanation ill-fitting, to say the best. And she came up to me after the meeting and she said, you know, you're right. I never really thought of it that way. And I didn't understand that my response to this was so influenced by my own experiences as a principal, my own experiences in school. So I think that that's just a good example of MCPS at first not being very closed in, not even wanting to talk about this publicly, not wanting to address policies and pattern and practice issues. And that's, you know, as I said, at the meeting, I suggested, you know, I think you really need to look at that, because there is no way that this is possibly acceptable.
Right. And so we have to figure out the best ways in which to approach them for both those things, for individual requests, as well as policy requests. And, you know, essentially, from my point of view, how policy requests work is that you gather together 200 folks, give them, you know, have them with placards, show up at a board meeting, and then sort of essentially shout down, but no, I mean, metaphorically, of course, everybody else. So that's been the general way in which we advocate for policies. But you are saying that it is possible to advocate more directly with staff.
But as somebody who has been involved in very difficult, stressful, you know, upsetting situations as a law enforcement attorney, as a private practice attorney. I used to do child sexual abuse cases against the Catholic Church. But one of the ways to get at, I think, solutions is to play, as we were talking about earlier, kind of the inside game, in the sense that you got to sit down in a conference room with the people who are empowered to make changes and lay out your case. And I do look at it somewhat as being, you know, being trained as and experienced as an advocate, but even more than that, just giving, empowering families, parents, students about how to, if you will, navigate the corridors of power, operate the levers of power, because you can do it. There are certain ways of doing it, but there are all kinds of conversations that I had that were not public, that nobody knows about, where I moved the battleship and affected some change. Yeah, I wasn't able to do all the things that I wanted, but in the crucible, so to speak, of what was happening at Churchill, which, as you know, had significant racial profiling issues, intolerance issues, bias issues, sexual assault, all kinds of things that needed a lot of, plus a bomb scare, shooter threats. So these are things, I agree that there is a very important public component, showing public passion, opposition, but organizations typically don't necessarily respond to that in ways that create systemic change. If those changes happen, they happen in a closed door meeting, in a boardroom, office, or conference room, where you basically make it very plain. This is something you need to do, just like with that associate superintendent example, right? Because she was adamant, we're not doing anything. We're not telling people. I was told, when I advocated in that particular situation with the school and with the district supervisor at MCPS, and I strongly urged them to make a public statement and tell parents, they said no. That MCPS said no. I said, I disagree, and I'm going to go over your head, because I think this decision is absolutely ridiculous.
But, you know, let's sort of ask the question, sit down in a conference room with people that are empowered to make decisions. That, all of that requires a level of knowledge and access that is not, you know, with everybody. So if you think about this, 32% of the county is foreign born.
Right.
we have significant numbers of folks that, you know, I would say do not have access to that kind of officialdom in that way, or the knowledge to identify who, in fact, who are the empowered people.
Yeah.
I don't, certainly. I mean, and I was neck deep in PTA.
Yeah, I know. You were, I know.
Right. And it is very hard to figure out where are the levers that you have to move.
I agree. Let's look at that. Let's kind of break it down a little bit. When I first started as a PTA president, I had no clue what the MCPS hierarchy was. Does the average parent know? Of course not. When you add in additional considerations of language, culture, and country of origin, that just makes it even more difficult. So let's start with that. That one of the areas that I think is important is at base, empowering parents just very basically to understand your school works like this. Above the school, you have the district coordinators, the district supervisors. Above them, you have this, that everything goes to the deputy superintendent. But here are ways that you can access the people you need to access. And that's going beyond the school, because often conversations with the principal are limited. The principal needs to get clearance for virtually anything significant. So going up to the district coordinator level and starting there, I had no clue about that, none. And I only learned about it because Churchill had serious racial profiling problems. It got so bad that parents of color, particularly African American parents, were just coming to me saying, we have to do something about this. And that's kind of how I learned what the pecking order system is, and then going up as needed to deal with serious issues as they present themselves. But I do think that the first step is educating parents and families. This is how the system works. This is where you can go. And that's aside from whether, of course, parents are prepared to advocate for their children. That's a separate consideration.
Correct.
But just some basic MCPS 101. This is how, let's break down the mystery of this enormous organization and give you the tools, if you choose to use them, about how to advocate for your children. And if, God forbid, something happens to your child, how you can deal with that and how you can deal with that successfully.
What is a mechanism that can do that?
You're going to need, unfortunately, a serious problem. You know, if you're going to complain, for example, that, you know, let's say Bruce is a 10th grade AP student and he got a B minus. I want that change and I'm going all the way up to the superintendent. Obviously, that's not really going to get you the result that you want, or that the MCPS is going to be responsive to that. But there are so many significant serious issues, whether they're drug use and abuse, assault, bullying, hazing, racial profiling. Look at the sexual assault and the crimes at Damascus High School a couple of years ago. Just terrible, terrible things.
Well, I agree with you, but I agree there are pattern problems. The thing I think from a systemic point of view is that it becomes very hard to separate the kind of, you know, my child got an A minus and deserves an A, from the really serious instances of profiling or bias or whatever else that you talked about, right? And how do you create a system that can, in real time, really make that distinction so that one set of, you know, the more serious issues are addressed, but the others don't become a burden on the system? Because it is the case that many parents will use that in order to burden the system. And then, you know, the system fails essentially from that burden.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I know that there are many situations where I had new parents who either came to me as a PTA president or I just knew as friends who had an issue with grade. We talked earlier about things that I wasn't able to achieve. This is one area that MCPS and in many dozens of individual schools provide zero information in the languages that parents need. I had parents come up to me, new immigrant parents, who would say through an interpreter or through a friend, my son, my daughter is, something is happening to them. They describe what it was, and it was concerning. And they said, but I don't know what to do. They don't give me any information in my language. I don't know how to communicate with the school. I'm not going to use my child as an interpreter. And I did relay these issues, you know, up the chain. So I think that's facilitating communication is very important. This school system does a poor job, and I would say a discriminatory job, in not communicating with people in ways they can understand.
Well, Bruce Adelson, I know you always set the agenda. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
for your time. And I hope to do this again with you. So what lessons can we learn from Miriam Schonbaum and Bruce Adelson? Miriam and Bruce emphasize two very different ways to advocate for change in local government. First, while Miriam adopted an outside approach, Bruce played the inside game. Both have been successful, but I think they will both say that advocacy doesn't get you everything you want. In pedestrian safety issues, there is now a Vision Zero coordinator in Montgomery County. There's a bill in Annapolis trying to shift the speed-setting authority, even on Maryland state-maintained roads, to the county government. There's also a bill that will make pedestrian safety study a part of the school design process. Bruce found success in pushing MCPS administration to recognize the importance of transparent action on issues such as bullying, racism, and harassment, and to have people in key positions, such as principals and directors, who recognize the transparent public communication is key to effective governance. It is interesting as well that both Miriam Schonbaum and Bruce Adelson can play the other game too. Miriam is very much involved in convincing the Department of Transportation to do the right thing. Bruce sees one of his failures is not being able to get other parents to advocate on behalf of their children. Their emphasis and choice in choosing their particular strategy speaks to how they understand the locus of change. Miriam clearly sees the problem as beyond just government agencies. And in the 100 years of road culture, backed by billions of dollars of investment in road infrastructure designed to ensure vehicle throughput. Consequently, her advocacy not only tries to change the minds of government officials, but of the public at large. And she sees change in the wider road culture as driving the political choices that politicians make, in particular about the departments of transportation and how to hold them more accountable. In contrast, Bruce sees the locus of change inside the vast bureaucracy of MCPS and emphasizes access and direct negotiation. He achieved this access by becoming the PTA president at Winston Churchill, one of the best-known public schools in the county, and used his position to push specific officials to consider new evidence and legal arguments. Bruce's approach is informed in part by who he is, a white man from one of the richest neighborhoods in the United States, with decades of legal training and experience. The same year that Bruce was PTA President of the Year, 2018-2019, I won the award for PTA Dad of the Year. My experience as an immigrant parent was very different from Bruce's. It was mostly about creating new venues where folks that did not feel like they could directly advocate with MCPS found a place nevertheless. That's our system, and admittedly, the problem with it. Since we have gone longer than usual in this episode, I will get back with things to do that I won't be able to in the next episode. Thank you for listening. I want to thank the guys at Ed's Not Dead Podcast for pointing me to this journey into podcasting, and AJ Campbell for early help, including making the logo art. Our music comes from the local band Soul Witness. I'm very much looking forward to showcasing local talent and especially local music students on the podcast. If you want to share your music on the show or know someone who might want to do it, please email us at ihppod@gmail.com or reach out on Twitter at ihppod. I hope you will subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and your home. See you next time.